welcome to NACSW's Podcast of the Month. Our podcast program makes available recordings of a wide variety of NACSW presentations and discussions on topics of particular interest to Christians and social work. Our Podcast of the Month program features a new podcast every 30 days for your listening pleasure. We hope you enjoy today's podcast.
The integration of faith for all those years, still want to get together, still love to work together, and want to plan another conference. So it's an exciting thing when you become connected with people who are interested in the same thing. Now, I have to admit that there's a lot of diversity in the group in terms of style of worship or particular issues around faith. We don't always see things the same way, but isn't that the beauty of learning? That we don't have to see things the same way, and that the challenge is to be able to look at faith and look at spiritual journeys and grow by sharpening each other. So just to let you know, if you don't have a session or something just happens and you've got some free time, just look around and start meeting these people that are here, because it's wonderful to be coming back year after year and just finding friends in this organization, friends that sharpen you. Thanks. And it's my pleasure to bring David Hodge up to the platform and let him do the introduction to our plenary speaker.
Good morning. It's my very great pleasure to be able to introduce our guest speaker this morning. There are a few individuals that, by dint of hard work, methodological innovation, and sound research, are able to achieve some degree of renown within their own particular profession. There's a smaller subsection of individuals whose work is so impressive that they're able to make an impact beyond their profession across various disciplines within the United States. Then there is still a smaller subgroup of individuals that might fall into the classification of world scholars. Their research is so impactful that they're known around the world for their area of expertise. And our speaker this morning falls into that category. To give you some kind of examples of the breadth and depth of his work, he's published over 300 peer-reviewed scientific journal articles or book chapters. He's published over 35 books. I went to print out his CV, but my printer quit after like 60 pages. It just ran out of ink. It just goes on and on and on, page after page, of just honor, award, accolade, etc. But perhaps the most important thing about our speaker this morning is he's able to join that sort of incredible academic prowess with a genuine, humble, earnest, open, and honest spirit. He is a fundamentally decent and warm human being, and it's very rare in my experience that you're able to marry those two characteristics together. So please join me in welcoming Dr. Harold Koning from Duke University.
Thank you, David. Well, I'm thrilled to be here, and I hope that over the next 45 minutes, I will be able to give you something that will be useful for you to be able to take to wherever you are and apply to your practices, as well as teach to your students and to your colleagues. So with that introduction, I'm going to move fairly quickly. Next. We're going to talk a little bit about defining terms, spirituality, religion, etc. We're going to talk about coping with illness and the role that religion plays. We don't have a pointer, Rick, do we? A little pointer. Check on that. Then we'll talk a little bit about the research on religion and mental health, research on religion and physical health, and then examine some further resources. I'm actually going to, if we don't, the pointer, oh, we got a pointer right here. Terrific. I'm actually going to dispense with too many jokes during this presentation. This is not an entertaining presentation, okay? This is going to be like an educational, informative one. So, next. Now, these terms are incredibly important because they set the stage for whatever we're going to talk about or deal with. And the term spirituality has been hijacked by the secular world. It's been hijacked from the original meaning of it, which comes up, you know, in Paul's teaching to the, you know, I forget who he was talking about, but that's where the first time it was. Okay. So now there is a big difference on the language you use clinically versus the language you would use in conducting research. Okay, I'm going to say that one more time. There's a big difference between the way terms are used clinically compared to how they're used in research. Next. Religion involves beliefs, practices, and rituals related to the sacred, where the sacred is that which relates to the mystical, the supernatural, or God in the Western religious traditions, or to ultimate truth or reality in the Eastern traditions. Religion may also involve beliefs about spirits, angels, demons. Religion usually have specific beliefs about the life after death and rules about conduct that guide life within a social group. Religion is often organized and practiced within a community, but it can also be practiced alone and in private. Central to its definition, however, is that religion is rooted in an established tradition that arises out of a group of people with common beliefs and practices concerning the sacred. This definition is generally agreed upon. So I can present that definition out to any group, and they can relate to that. Yeah, that's kind of what religion is. It's also distinctive and separate from other social and psychological concepts. And that's very important when you start thinking about research, scientific research, where you have to, you know, you have to have terms that are very different, that are measurable and distinguishable from other terms. This means we can measure religion and correlate it with mental, social, and physical health. Okay, this is why I'm going to be using the word religion throughout most of my talk. Next. Spirituality is more difficult to define than religion. It is a more popular expression today than religion, since many view the latter as divisive and associated with war, conflict, fanaticism. Spirituality is considered more personal, something individuals define for themselves, that is largely free of the rules, regulations, and responsibilities associated with religion. In fact, there's a growing group of individuals that categorize themselves as spiritual but not religious, who deny any connection at all with religion and understand spirituality entirely in individualistic, secular, humanistic terms. Everyone is considered spiritual, both religious and secular. This contemporary use of spirituality is quite different from its original meaning. Because there is no common agreed-upon definition, because everyone is considered spiritual, measurement for research purposes is problematic. Next. Spirituality today, now this is true in social work and in nursing, and certainly in psychology. Spirituality is either measured as religion or it's measured as positive psychological or character traits. Positive psychological states include having purpose and meaning in life, being connected with others, experiencing peace, harmony, and well-being. Now, most of us would say, yeah, you know, I can relate to that. That's what. But you have to understand something with regard to the order of effects. You cannot define spirituality that way because the consequences of spirituality are those. You can't define spirituality as that What is the, let me give you an example. The fruit of the Spirit are love, patience, etc. It's not the Spirit itself. It's the fruit of the Spirit. The consequences of a spiritual life grounded and rooted in a religious faith. Positive character traits include being forgiving, great mind. Now, I talked to the other group of social workers not long ago, the spirituality and social work, that group, they have an association too. They're not, you know, they're more the New Age kind of group. This is what I was trying to tell them. Now, they didn't go over very well, you know. But there's enough of a logic here that it's fairly solid. In fact, this is coming out in the April issue of the Journal of Nervous and Mental Disease, which is one of the top psychiatric journals in the field. So this will be in print. Next. So I'm going to just illustrate what has happened with the term spirituality over the years. Next. Kind of reinforcing. The traditional historical understanding of spirituality was that it was a subgroup of religious individuals who were deeply religious and whose lives exemplified the teachings of their faith. We're talking about Mother Teresa's, you know, we're talking about Luther, etc. These were spiritual people. Next. Then the modern understanding has expanded spirituality. Now, you can still study this from a research perspective. You can still look at these people who consider themselves religious and spiritual but not religious, and compare them to the secular. Now, what exactly who these people are who are spiritual but not religious is anybody's guess. You're spiritual and not religious. Okay, so what does that mean? And that's very unclear. In fact, when we try to measure who those people are, all you can do is you can say, they have to, literally, you give them four categories. Are you religious and spiritual? Are you religious but not spiritual? Are you spiritual but not religious? Or are you neither? I mean, that's the only way to be able to identify those people. Next. Now, this is what's happening in research among the spirituality researchers today. It's expanded to include mental health. And that's the problem. Because that now gives an unfair advantage to spirituality over secular, you know, whereas secular is not defined as mental health. Next. This is the clinical understanding. And this is okay, but it's not researchable. You can't study this. But this is the way clinically. In fact, this is the appropriate way in many respects clinically to deal with the subject, is that you use a very broad definition of spirituality, you meet people where they are, and you address their needs in whatever language they use. Next. So in summary, when talking about research, I will talk in terms of religion defined as a multidimensional concept, not just going to church, but as a multidimensional concept consisting of 20 different dimensions or more, different aspects of religion, experience, practice, personal, group, etc. When conducting research, spirituality should be understood in traditional terms as a subset of deeply religious whose lives and lifestyles reflect their faith. And this is what I'm trying to get across to every group that I speak to, secular, non-secular, etc. When clinical applications are concerned, the term spirituality should be used where spirituality is broadly inclusive and self-defined by patients themselves. Next. Okay. Now we start kind of moving into the area of research. Many people turn to religion for comfort when they're sick, and you all know that. You probably wouldn't be here today if you didn't realize that. Religion is used to cope with problems common to those with medical illness. And this is why, this is part of the power of the argument to the secular world that this is appropriate and needs to be addressed as part of all medical care, because people turn to religion in trying to cope with uncertainty, fear, pain, disability, loss of control, discouragement, and loss of hope. And this is all over the place in medical settings. When people are sick, it's all over the place. We do research on depression in the medically ill, and it's present at Duke Hospital. At Duke Hospital, it's present and in surrounding community hospitals around Duke. It's present in 50% of patients. Depression, a diagnosable depressive disorder among people over 60, is present in close to 50%. In people under 60, it's even higher. In young people, depression is more common than among older people, partly because in older people, when you get sick and disabled and in pain, you kind of expect that when you get old. But when you're young and you have that, you don't expect it. You feel cheated, and then you become angry, and then you become depressed. Next. So at Duke Hospital, if we do a survey of people over 60, consecutive admissions to the hospital, we find that if you ask people, how much do you use religion to cope? We find that 40% will say it's the most important factor that enables them to cope. This is a consecutive series of patients admitted to medicine, cardiology, neurology. So 40% will circle 10 on a 0 to 10 scale. And another 50% will circle somewhere between 5 and 10. So you've got only 10% circling something below 5 on that 0 to 10 scale. Now, you all could do a research study like this at your institution. It's very simple. You know, you get an IRB, you know, it goes through the IRB, and they, you know, get a consent. And then you just give them a scale from 0 to 10. It's, you know, a visual analog scale, and say, to what extent does religion, do you use religion to help you to cope? Then you show that to your administrator and say, should we be ignoring this? I guess, you know, the way it is now, you know, I guess we're not supposed to be talking about this. So the fact that, you know, 80% of our patients are using it may be a reason that to justify addressing these issues. Next. And it's similar, really, around the United States. You think, okay, well, at Duke Hospital, yeah, you're in the Bible Belt, you're in the South, but when people get stressed out, you can see from this study published in the New England Journal of Medicine that 9 out of 10 people after September 11th turned to religion. This is all over the United States. This is like New York and California, Alaska. 9 out of 10 people turned to religion in coping with September 11th. Next. God, if you're up there, give me a sign. Next. Let's go quickly over and look at the relationship between religion and mental health, which we can study, because religion is separate from mental health. Religion involves a distinct concept, category, that we can compare people who are more or less religious with on their mental health. Next. Now, Freud was very negative towards religion. Next. I mean, we don't need to go over this. He said the whole thing was so patently infantile, so incongruous with reality. To someone whose attitude to humanity is friendly, it is painful to think that the great majority of mortals will never be able to rise above this view of life. You know, that gives you just a sense. Next. Next. This is a little study about 20 years old now. I was kind of getting involved and interested in this study. I was a young family practice resident. And so I did this survey in the Midwest, basically in Iowa and Missouri and Illinois, and measured people's religious attendance and their intrinsic religiosity and measured their well-being. I figured you could do that. There were scales, you know, that were developed. And lo and behold, those with high religious involvement had the highest level of well-being. That was kind of exciting. You could actually document that and statistically show that and then get it published in a secular journal. Next. Then came to Duke about 20, 25 years ago and was stationed at the VA and then did a study looking at depression and religious coping. And again found that those with very high religious coping had lower depression scores, suggesting that this was helping them to cope with the medical problems. And this was close to 1,000 men. And relationships in men, in particular, seem to be weaker than in women with regard to religion. But even in men, you see this effect where there's a halving, literally a halving, the rate of depression among those who with very high levels of religious coping. Next. This is a study not just looking at the correlation, but actually measuring the person's depth of their religious faith when they come into the hospital, and then following them up over a year and looking at what the course of their depression is. First, identifying depressed patients in the hospital, measuring their depth of their religious faith, and then following them for a year afterwards to see what happens to their depression. Are those with deep religious faith coping better, getting over their depression faster than those without deep religious faith? That's the question. And you can see here that depression doesn't last as long in those who are highly religious. You can see that graphically, that they recover more quickly from depression than those with low religiosity. This was published in the American Journal of Psychiatry. Next. Most recently, about 6 months ago, we completed a study of not 87 depressed patients, but 845 depressed patients. It's the largest study ever done of depression in the medically ill, where they were followed over time. This is based on an NIH study. And we were able to show in that study, we identified the 14% of those patients who were deeply religious, who are going regularly to church, who are praying regularly, who are reading the Bible or other religious literature regularly, who had a deep measure of intrinsic religious motivation. And that 14% recovered about 50% faster than everybody else, independent, of course, of all other factors that might influence the course of depression, including psychiatric treatments and severity of medical illness, etc. Next. This is just looking at the relationship with suicide rate that kind of drills home this relationship that church attenders have low church attenders have the highest suicide rate. And then it, as church attendance goes up, suicide rate goes down. You can see there's a pretty hefty correlation here on that. Next. Looking at anxiety disorders, large random sample, people of all ages, that it's not just in the old, that in the young as well, anxiety is less among those who are more deeply religious. Next. So, are you plagued by doubt? Do you question the existence of God? Is your faith challenged by the vicissitudes of modern life? Do you think the church is full of phonies and hypocrites? You may suffer from a spiritual anxiety disorder. Try Prozac. Citing new over-the-counter pharmaceutical, 9 out of 10 ministers recommend. He was not expecting to hear that on TV. You can see that. Next. So a lot of research done on spiritual and mental health, religion and mental health. Prior to the year 2000, there were 724 quantitative studies. Close to 500 of those showed that the religious person had significantly better mental health. Now, why is it that we have had this impression that religion and mental health are somehow not associated or not connected in any way, that religious people, if anything, are more neurotic, which is what we get trained in our social work schools and medical school, etc. Why is it when there's this much research out there? Well, part of it has to do with that it was never brought together in one place before 2000. It was published in journals in all different disciplines and nobody, you know, really communicated across disciplines, and sometimes they would measure religion and they wouldn't even report the relationship in the paper. So what we did, we went back and we looked at all of this research. We brought it all together to show that, in fact, in secular journals, most of the research shows that religious people have better mental health than everybody else, which is the opposite of what we've been trained. Next. Now, what's happened since the year 2000? In fact, there has been more research done since the year 2000 in the last 8 years on spirituality, religion, and health than had been done in the 100 years prior to the year 2000. In the entire history of research being done, there is more research being done in the last 8 years than there was the entire time prior to this. So that means that a lot of research is being done now in this area. This is moving into mainstream. It is becoming more and more credible as an accepted area of research and study. And the consequence of that is that clinical practice always follows the research. So we're going to see more and more, I think, this becoming more acceptable within medicine, within nursing, within social work, that these areas are acknowledged and addressed. And, I'm excited to kind of report that. Next. Now, let's look at physical health. Because, you know, what doctors, what the healthcare system, they really don't care if somebody's depressed or anxious, as long as they're not consuming medical resources. You know, it's all about the bottom line, the dollar. So they care. You know, if you have health problems, you're sicker, and you're using up a lot of resources, you know, that's what everybody cares about. In fact, depressed people a lot of times don't even use resources. They don't really care, so they don't take care of themselves, and they, you know, end up dying or committing suicide or whatever. So the healthcare system, well, you know, that's a problem, but that's not that big a deal because that's not going to cost us that much money. People like this. So, but what many didn't anticipate was that mental health affects physical health, and you can't just ignore depression or anxiety because that is a major factor leading to the use of health services. So let's look at that. Next. So here we have a scientific model to try to understand how religion might influence physical health. You wouldn't even have to be religious to understand that this would make logical sense. In fact, even if God didn't exist, if this is all made up. Now, I believe that God exists. You know, I'm a person of faith. But even if God didn't exist, and we're all fabricating this just to, you know, make us feel better, this would work exactly the same way. So the good thing about this is that, you know, atheists, you know, or scientists are not threatened by a model like this because it just relies on logic. If religion influences mental health, if you can accept the fact that people cope better if they're more religious, if they have less anxiety and they perceive, you know, stressful circumstances in a more positive light, then that's going to influence known relationships with physiological systems that mental health affects. We now know that the mind influences the body in these various ways. And the immune system, that depressed people have weaker immune systems, and then if you're stressed out, you're going to be more likely to get a cold, or not only that, but your wounds are not going to heal as quickly after surgery if you're depressed or anxious because you've got high cortisol levels, and that's affecting your immune functioning, which is necessary for wounds to close. All of this information, we're now understanding that mental health is associated with these factors, that social factors are associated with all of these different critical systems for healing, critical systems for recovery, the immune system, autonomic nervous system that controls heart rate, blood pressure, pulse, the ability to detect diseases early and get people to comply. All of these factors seem to be influenced by these factors, and religion seems to influence these factors. And therefore, religion ought to influence physical health just by pure logic. So let's look a little bit at this next. Now, this is one of the first studies looking at immune functioning and religious attendance. 1,700 randomly selected people in North Carolina, drew their blood, measured their interleukin 6, which is an indicator of immune functioning, and found that religious people, people attending religious services more often, have more positive levels of IL-6 in their blood than people who are not attending services. In fact, as you grow older, your IL-6 levels actually go up. That's just because your immune system is getting weaker as you get older. You know, that's why people get cancer as they get older, because their immune systems can't gobble up those cancer cells as well. So older people have higher levels of IL-6. People with AIDS or HIV positive individuals have high levels of IL-6 because their immune systems are not working as well. But people who attend church actually have IL-6 levels that are equivalent to those of younger people who are not attending church. Isn't that interesting? Next. Also, blood pressure appears to be lower among those who are more religious, particularly those attending services regularly and praying, reading the Bible. So people who not only socially involve themselves, but also privately in their private time, if they do both, that seems they have the lowest blood pressure. Next. Now, is this all applying to Christians? Most of it is, to be honest with you. Most of it is. 90% of these studies involve Christian patients, Christian subjects. But it also applies to other religions to some extent. We don't have good comparison studies, but here, these are 10,000 Jews in Israel. They were followed for 24 years. Those who are more devout, those who went to synagogue regularly, those who did the religious rituals in the home, those who sent a child to a religious school, they had a 20% reduction in mortality from coronary artery disease. So there does appear to be some, you know, across religions as well. Is it the same as within Christianity? We don't know. There are a lot of reasons, though, why these relationships ought to work better in Christians, because Christians see God as personal, as present, as loving and caring, where that isn't influenced as much. Well, depending on some Jewish traditions, though. I mean, they see God in very personal ways, too, but you have a large secular Jewish population. Islam sees God as more distant, doesn't see God as, you know, being as present and as caring and as forgiving and as merciful, because the consequences, of course, in Islam, you know, there's a big, big price to pay in the next life if you don't shape up in this life. And so Buddhism, Hinduism, again, you know, seeing God, but not that personal. Now, the personal nature of God in Christianity may have some of the effects on mental health. May have some unique effects on mental health. Well, it would just make sense, you know. I mean, the emphasis on forgiveness, on mercy, as you're talking about talking to people, you know, going through a lot of stress, God being present. These things have mental health consequences that would appear to be positive, that other religions might not have as much. But we don't know that. I couldn't stand up before a non-Christian audience and say what I just did. I probably wouldn't. I would probably say, well, you know, there are relationships in other religions, and we don't have good comparison data to know whether or not, you know, Christians have any better mental health or physical health than non-Christians, because there is data in other populations that show similar relationships. And I think that's current state of the science. That's where we are. Next. This just shows you again. This is out of Dartmouth now. This is out of New Hampshire. People with low social support, low religious involvement, have high mortality rates after surgery. Because, again, you can see logically how this would work. If you have low social support and low religion, you're not going to cope as well. You're going to probably have more depression. Your wounds are not going to heal as quickly. They're going to be more susceptible to infection because immune system isn't working as well. And you're going to have worse outcomes. So this makes a lot of logical sense. These people are 14 times as likely to die as these people. And this is out of Dartmouth. This is, you know, psychosomatic medicine. This is secular group reporting these findings. Next. So in summary, a lot of research done prior to the year 2000 on religion and physical health. Next. I'm going to go quickly. I'm not even going to... A lot of exciting research done in the last 8 years. In fact, a lot of exciting research done in the last 3 years. Religious attendance, lower mortality in Mexican Americans. Religious attendance associated with a slower progression of cognitive impairment with aging in Mexican Americans. So isn't that interesting? In fact, there's two studies now coming out of this data set that shows that religiously involved people have a slower cognitive decline as they get older. Here's a study in neurology, the top neurology journal in the world, showing that Alzheimer's disease patients who are more religious have a slower decline in their cognitive functioning over time. Actually, these are Kaufman is actually a Jewish fella in Israel now. And we've been going back and forth. We actually have developed a relationship, me and Kaufman. He's very interested in this. He's a neurologist. In had been in Canada, actually. It was at the Toronto is where they did this study. Fewer complications following cardiac surgery. That's another study. This one's out of Rutgers. Greater longevity if living in a religiously affiliated neighborhood. Now, the secular people love this finding because this shows that you don't even have to be religious as long as your neighbors are religious. And so coming to this conference is probably something healthy for you. Now, look at this one. This is in the British Medical Journal. This shows that young people who attend religious services, get this, are more protected from meningococcal meningitis than young people who are vaccinated with the bacteria. Isn't that amazing? This is in the British Medical Journal. Next. And it just goes on and on. Again, recent studies. These are all 2006. Older adults who attend church more often have less fear of falling than those who aren't attending services. Isn't that interesting? We know what happens when people develop fear of falling, of course. They stop ambulating. They go to bed. They lose bone mass. They lose balance. They fall down when they want to go to the bathroom and break their hip. And that's all she wrote. So this is a fact. And many studies, well, not many, but several very well-done studies show that religious involvement delays the onset of disability in later life. And that would be consistent with this. Now, Gail Ironson yesterday was at Duke presenting the results from a study done in Miami, University of Miami, showing that, now this is really, really cool stuff. I mean, I wish I could talk to you about this, you know, all day, but she was able to show, and this got published in the Journal of General Internal Medicine, that when patients are diagnosed with HIV, if they turn to religion, they have a slower progression of the disease. I mean, she is able to show, using hierarchical linear regression, actually predicting the slopes of disease progression. I mean, David may know a little bit about this stuff, but this is really, really high-tech statistical analyses that shows that the viral load in these people who turn to religion increases more slowly. Statistically, more slowly. And the CD4 count doesn't decline as rapidly over 4 years. And in particular, what she found, she hasn't published this yet, she just reported yesterday, was that people who view God in a loving God have this effect in particular, independent of their church attendance. So when you control for church attendance, those who believe in a loving, caring God have a slower progression of their AIDS. Okay, so very exciting stuff. religion and survival. Even in Europe, where very few people are religious, it seems to have effects on mortality. And, you know, this is another Jewish study showing that, you know, that in Israel, those who are more attending synagogue regularly tended to be alive, you know, after more than other people who weren't doing that. So, okay. Now, if you want to see this research, go to our website. This is a portal of entry into. In fact, there is a PDF file there. You can literally go to the website, click on the PDF, and get a summary of all of these studies and citations. It's like 70, 80 pages. You can print that out and you have it all right there. You have the journal. You'll have the summary of the research, what they found, etc. And over 70 studies since 2004, and that was back in 2007, I think, about a year ago that I figured this out. 70 recent studies show these positive findings. Next, because I'm running out of time here. In fact, I'm way over. Next. Now, if any of you want to learn how to do research, and I'm hoping that I can excite some of you to do research, because if you want to influence your field, there is no better way than research. And naturally, if you are clinically taking care of people, that's a good thing. You are making a difference in their lives. But Christians in general tend to be those kinds of people that make a difference in individual lives, and that's good. But from the research standpoint, that's not good. Because they don't like research, they don't get into research, and therefore, as Dave and I were talking about, research is controlled by the secular world. And they are directing clinical practice. They're telling you you can't talk to a patient about their faith. That's the result of Christians not getting involved and learning the skills on how to conduct research. So if there are some young people in the audience that might be interested in research and academic career, come to our workshop. This is a 2-year postdoctoral research fellowship that's crammed into 5 days. I mean, this is intense. This is from like 8:30 in the morning till 5, 6 o'clock at night. And you are just drilled on how to conduct research, how to get grants, how to write papers, how to develop a research career, and impersonal mentorship is provided in your particular project that you may be working on. So send me an email if you're at all interested in that. Next. Now, we are running over. And let me just very quickly go into clinical applications, then I'll open it up for a few questions, and then we'll have to stop. Next. I'm going to go really fast here. Next. I told you I was going to go really fast. You all know why we ought to be addressing this. That slide was about trying to argue why we should be addressing spiritual issues in clinical practice. Go back one slide. I think, you know, I want you to be able to argue within your field, within your colleagues, that this is, first of all, many patients are religious and would like it addressed in their health care. Many patients have spiritual needs related to illness that could affect their mental health but go unmet. We know this. Patients, particularly when hospitalized, are often isolated from religious communities. So, you know, these needs are not addressed. Religious beliefs affect medical decisions and may conflict with treatments. That's why we need to know about these beliefs. Religion influences health care in the community after discharge, the kind of support people receive. And JACO requires a spiritual history be done on every single patient admitted to any hospital, nursing home, or home health agency that gets Medicare or Medicaid funding. Now, that seems to be news to a lot of people when I go talk that this is a requirement. You know, it's just not being done. And JACO is just cutting off points because it's not done, not documented. Next. So how do you address it? Healthcare professionals should take a brief screening spiritual history on all patients with serious or chronic medical illness. The physician should be doing this. Yeah, really. Like, 1 in 10 physician does this, if you're lucky. That means 9 aren't doing it. A brief explanation should precede the spiritual history. Ask people, you know, prepare them for the spiritual history. Otherwise, the patient will panic. They say, well, why are you asking me about religion? You know, am I dying or something? Is this illness worse? So explain, you know, you're doing this with everybody, you're required to do it, etc. So brief explanation, information to be acquired, and I'll go over that. You know, what do you need? What is a spiritual history consist of? Information from the spiritual history should be documented. There should be a place in the chart where you can document this, a special place. Now, this isn't happening, but in the future, I think we're going to see this. Refer to chaplains if spiritual needs are identified. You should probably always refer to chaplains if they're available and if there are really spiritual needs, other than very simple spiritual needs, because chaplains are trained to address these needs. Next. Screening spiritual history, 2 to 4 minutes. It's not the same as a spiritual assessment that the chaplain does. Just wanted to clarify the difference. The screening spiritual history is done by physician, not nurse, a lot of times not social worker. Okay? I think that's the order. Nurses really should be the ones doing this, but they're not. Therefore, if they're not doing it and it's nowhere documented, then there's nobody else left to do it than the social worker. I mean, who else is writing in the charter clinically taking care of these patients? There is nobody else other than, you know, the cleaning lady ends up doing the spiritual assessment and ministering to the patient half the time. But okay, so purpose of the spiritual history is to obtain information about religious background, beliefs, and rituals that are relevant to health care. That's why we're doing this. That's our argument for doing it. Nobody can fault you for doing it because your goal is health care. Now, if your goal is to lead them to Jesus or to bring them salvation, that ain't going to be well looked upon by your colleagues. And it's probably not something that you in your workplace ought to be doing with patients. I know that's a little shaky to be saying that, but I think we are moving to a time where it's not ethically allowed to do that. Your goal needs to be the health care of the patient. If you do this, you're protected. You really are protected. ACLU can't go after you. Freedom From Religion Foundation can't go after you. Yep. And they are going after groups legally. They are going after groups. They are suing them, even chaplains of the VA. They had a major lawsuit trying to get the chaplains not to be doing all this spiritual assessment. You know, Iraqi vets coming back from Afghanistan and Iraq with legs blown off. They're saying, no, you can't do a spiritual assessment on all these people. So, in any case, if your goal is health, you can do it. I mean, because that's the law. I mean, you can, anything related to health, as long as your goal is the health of the patient, you can address issues related to health, because that's our business. Social work, medicine, nursing, the health of the patient. And if there is clear research showing that a factor affects health outcomes, then can you ethically ignore that? You know, I don't think so. Next. Okay. Information acquired. Next. I really want to give a little time to... Okay, next. Refer to a chaplain. Next. Okay. Key roles of the medical social worker. Be familiar with the patient's religious background and experiences. And if spiritual history not done, do it. Document it. Sensible spiritual interventions include supporting the patient's beliefs, praying with patients if requested, ensuring that spiritual needs are met. So you can argue this in any setting. I can say this at any place that I go, Harvard Grand Rounds or Duke Grand Rounds. You know, I can say that. Those are sensible interventions all health professionals ought to be doing. On discharge, ask questions such as, Were your spiritual needs met to your satisfaction during your hospital stay? Are there still some issues that you need some help with? I mean, you can all do this. And a social worker is the person, you know, that's coordinating all this discharge stuff. For patients with unmet spiritual needs, work with chaplains to develop a spiritual care plan to be carried out in the community after discharge. For the religious patient, after permission is obtained, social worker or chaplain should contact patient's clergy to ensure a smooth transition home or to a nursing home to ensure follow-up on unmet spiritual needs. Next. Now, I'm ending with this, and we have a few time for questions, and we got to stop. Do not prescribe religion to non-religious patients. Do not do that. Do not force a spiritual history if the patient is not religious. Now, you can kind of broaden it out, and you say, okay, well, you're not religious. Okay, well, what gives your life a sense of purpose and meaning? See, now clinically, now I'm saying, okay, now include that in the spirituality part. You know, so you can easily talk to people about what gives their life a purpose and meaning in the setting of their illness. And that may lead then to a discussion of their religious and more distinct religious needs. Don't coerce patients in any way to believe or practice. Do not pray with a patient before taking a spiritual history and unless the patient asks. Now, what you can do is this. You can tell the patient, Mrs. Jones, I just want you to know that I pray with patients if that's something they want. So let me know at some future time if that's something that you would like. Don't ask them to respond at the immediate time you're asking, because if you ask a patient to pray, they are in a coercive situation where they can't refuse. Okay, they want to please their health professional, including their social worker, nurse, doctor. So they can't refuse. You're coercing, which is not ethical. So let them know. Say, hey, you know, I pray with patients. If that's something they like, I've taken your spiritual history. I understand that this is something important to you. Just let me know if that's something important. Now, if the patient says, okay, yes, it is important. Let's pray now. Then you say, okay, well, let's pray. You know, because the patient. But you have to give the patient freedom to non-coercively refuse. Then it's up to them. Do not do any activity that is not patient-centered, patient-directed. It's about the patient. It's about the patient. Not about your beliefs necessarily. Next. Okay. In summary, there's a great deal of systematic research indicating that religion is related to better coping, better mental health, better physical health, and may impact medical outcomes. There are good clinical reasons for assessing and addressing the spiritual needs of patients. Good clinical reasons. A spiritual history should be taken and documented on all patients and care adapted to address those needs. Social workers play a key role in assessing spiritual needs and ensuring that they are met, particularly after discharge. There are boundaries and limitations, however, and it is important to work with chaplains and pastoral counselors in addressing the spiritual needs of patients. Do we have 5-10 minutes for questions?
Yes.
Okay, great. So, any questions at all? And I'll give you a few minutes to start thinking about it, because I know you've been listening, but start thinking of questions. Yes. Well, that's a very interesting point. So could you get disciplined by saying, I just want you to know that I'm open to praying with patients if that's something that they want? If you say it in those terms, could you get disciplined? You could, I guess. I guess you could. It's a low probability. I would say it's a fairly low probability. Maybe 10 to 15%. That's why you take a spiritual history before you do this. You know, if you find out you've got a Jehovah's Witness, you know, you don't tell them, well, if you'd like to pray with me. You know, I pray with people. You don't do that. So you've taken a spiritual history. You understand their spiritual background. You know about that. And that's when you... So that'll protect you probably 99% of the time. They're not going to go complain to anybody. Yes?
I would think since there are chaplains that are part of the healthcare team, corporately you're covered. It's just a boundary professional kind of thing, maybe. That would be my first thought. Sometimes we run into that as far as boundaries, that kind of thing.
Yes. Yeah, you know this line, and it's true with nursing too. This is a line that there's conflict over on who does what. You know, there's some physicians actually saying that no one should pray with a patient but a chaplain. No one. I mean, I disagree with that, and I've said that publicly, and I've written that publicly, that I disagree with that. That, you know, it's not complicated to pray with a patient. But there are these boundary issues, and It's a challenge. You got to work with the chaplains. You got to work with them. They are trained. You know, I'm working with the chaplains. We've got work to do on the chaplains too, because the chaplains have bought into this huge, broad spirituality thing, and they've done so for their own survival purposes, because they're not going to survive if they just focus on, you know, one religion. But you would hope that the chaplains would, recognizing they have a Christian patient, would be able to go deep within that person's faith tradition. And that is what, you know, we're trying to get chaplains. Chaplains now are in a state of flux, too, in their education and in what they feel they can do and can't do. So we're working on them. But there is only 1 in 5 patients sees a chaplain. There are not enough chaplains around. And in terms of discharge planning, almost never is there any spiritual care plan after discharge done. The chaplain comes in and sees them and say, okay, you know, how you doing? You know, may say a prayer with them. That's it. You know, they don't follow up with their... And so there's a lot to do at discharge, because these people are in the hospital for 2 to 3 days. And they've got these spiritual needs you can't possibly address. And then they're all of a sudden back into the community. And they may be older people, maybe living alone, or maybe going back to a nursing home where they get, no one will address their spiritual needs. You can see there's this huge gap that social workers can fill here, huge gap in this transition in the community. Yes. Very good question. The answer is no. The answer is no to your question. They won't do as well. Because we're all, sure, we're religious, but nobody's just, there's not religious versus not religious. We're on some spectrum. And we're all, when I had cancer surgery 6 weeks ago. And when I went to the hospital, you know, I had a lot of spiritual needs. I was scared to death. I didn't know what was going to happen. You know, I I would have liked to have seen a chaplain. I would have liked to have talked to a chaplain, or I had spiritual needs that I was scared. I was, you know, my faith was, you know, when I went under the bone scanner, boy, I had a panic attack. I had to pray, you know, pray, where's God? It was like, God wasn't there at that moment. I didn't perceive him, so I had a panic attack. You know, so people of all levels of different faith need support when they get sick. And that support and that follow-up reminds them that God is with them and hasn't left them. And people are how God does that. And so as you are able to do that, you are boosting their coping abilities.
Even,
you got it. That's exactly it. That has not been done. Totally unstudied. Totally unstudied. Spiritual interventions and the effects that in various levels of religious involvement, how does that affect then their health outcomes, etc. Next level of research. We're just starting this research. This is just the tip of the iceberg. There is massive amounts of work left to be done. Massive. Other questions?
One more?
Okay. Go to the Jayco website. They've got a couple of little pieces on there, and it kind of helps you at least know what questions to ask that can then formulate your care plan, because they've got the requirements, and then the next page there's like 10 or 11 things, you know, that you have to do. I mean, it's on the Jayco website. You know, you can, you know, if you're worried about your superior, you can say, "Well, I'm sorry, I just went to the Jayco website and I'm just doing what they're requiring us to do. Sorry." You know, so go there and use that as to help form your plan.
Harold, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Harold, NACSW is extremely grateful for the passionate leadership that you've given in the academy, in research, but also in trying to help associations like ours figure out how can we plug into the exciting work that you're doing. You've been inspiring, and I hope that much of what you're saying does.
Thank you for joining us today for NACSW's Podcast of the Month featured selection. We hope you found today's session useful and that it will support your efforts to ethically integrate Christian faith and social work practice. We also hope that you will consider participating in additional NACSW activities and events, such as NACSW's upcoming Convention 2011 in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, from October 20th to 23rd, our quarterly audio conference workshops that we offer at no cost to NACSW members, and access to dozens of archived podcasts from the member section of our website. Also, we invite you to join NACSW's Facebook group or our Facebook fan page. For additional information about these and other NACSW benefits and services, you can go to our website at www.nacsw.org. Thanks again for listening into our podcast session today.